What is it that scares you? What are you afraid of? I learned that I'm claustrophobic, or that I can't deal with confined spaces, when I was a child and we went caving and I almost stopped breathing. I guess that's a pretty valid fear. This week at MYF, we were playing 20 questions with Cassidy, who is the new youth intern. And someone asked her, "What are you afraid of?" While some of the youth kind of oohed and awed at, "Ooh, it's getting pretty deep," Cassidy answered very honestly, telling us some of her surface fears, but also some of the deeper fears that she holds. What is it that you fear? But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. The people of Israel were complaining a bit to Moses. They did that a lot. But they were also asking something of God. They wanted a prophet. Someone who would lead them once Moses was gone and had left them. Someone who would listen to the voice of God for them and bring that message to them. It's a huge weight to be a prophet. God will hold accountable those who don't listen to the prophet. But if the prophet doesn't speak God's words, that prophet shall die. This is heavy stuff and somewhat daunting for a preacher. The stakes feel slightly higher getting up here after reading a passage like that. The people of Israel wanted to follow God, but they got a bit scared of being too close to God. And with good reason. Some of the acts of God are a bit terrifying. Violent storms, a pillar of fire, things being destroyed. So they asked to have a prophet, a leader, an intermediary to help them listen to God. A prophet who would give them the space to take a little step away from having to look full into the face of God. So now, let's go back to that idea of fear. Is fear a good thing? What are we afraid of? Yes, there are those little surface fears, a fear of snakes, maybe of falling, a fear of heights, a fear of the dark. But what about those big fears? A fear that we won't be loved, that we will fail, that we won't be able to have children, that we will be neglected or forgotten when we are gone. How do we relate to these fears, and are we consciously aware of them? How might these fears be controlling us? How often do we name these deep fears? And how often do we acknowledge the power that they have over us? One of my favorite books in the Bible is the book of Psalms. As I read the Psalms, I am often jarred by lines like, "Happy are those who fear the Lord." This is not the way that I'm used to the word fear being used. Fear of God does not give me that warm, fuzzy feeling. How is the idea of fear of God used in the Bible? Is it a good thing? Is it awe and respect? Or is there something more there? Is some fear of God good for us? The Bible uses the word fear at least 300 times in reference to God. So we may need to be careful not to downplay this idea or brush it aside. We shouldn't dilute the concept of fear of God as just piety or reverence. This fear is knowing God in sheer awesomeness, loving God utterly and exclusively. This absolute love of God means total surrender. Scripture is full of examples of how fearing God is a positive rather than a negative thing. Yet this fear is still of something that might be hazardous or feel unsafe. Like the people of Israel, we might want to not be too up close and personal with this God because it feels dangerous, like stepping too close to a raging fire. But when Jesus shows up, he is the true revelation of God. Here is God with a human face on, with human skin. Jesus' teaching in this story here in Mark is met with awe and astonishment. Wow, he is an amazing teacher. And he teaches with such authority. Jesus' teachings and actions feel like something new, and he is welcomed with amazement. And he impresses those who hear him and see him act. Does this Jesus still instill the fear of God? God knew we needed an approachable face of God. Do we at times run to this Jesus that feels more accessible and less threatening, and in so doing, forget that God is bigger and deserves or demands our awe? Over and over, the story plays out in the Old Testament. The people distance themselves from God and fall away. And then they are drawn back to the closeness with God as they revisit the covenant. God doesn't change, but as people shy away from God and step back and let someone else relate to God for them, they take less seriously following God and God being the ultimate in their lives. Not that we want to be driven by fear, but when we step away from God, we lose some of that awe and relationship, and thus find it easier to step away from following God as well. If we don't have some of that immediacy and that admiration or reverence for God, then we start to place other things into the spot in our lives that God should be. When God is not demanding our attention, our obedience, our ultimate allegiance, then other things creep into that space. We may not have idols like they did in the time that Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, but idols are still here, and their power possibly more toxic because we don't name them for what they are. We worship consumerism and materialism. We follow the god of personal success and entitlement. We bow down to the god of individualism and let the push and stress of busyness cut us off from others. Maybe we don't have idols that sit in temples like statues, but they do surround us in our media, our institutions, and our technologies. When this goes unnamed, they may have more power over us than we have over them. Have we lost sight of God and the place of honor and worship that God should have in our lives? Have we replaced the fear of God with fear of our own creation? The church at Corinth were dealing with the issue of eating meat that was sacrificed to idols. The issue that Paul addresses with them is this: don't let your knowledge of God trip you up. It is not you knowing God, but you loving God and God knowing you. I want to say it again so you hear that. It is not you knowing God, but you loving God and God knowing you. How this love spills over into the community is again us not abusing what we know, but thinking of the larger community and how our actions of faith affect others. It is not that Paul is concerned just that the weaker members of the community will fall away. He is afraid that it will destroy them and their connection to God. Do we think our knowledge of God is so great that it removes us from looking out for those who are more vulnerable around us? I will admit that when I go out for a drink with my friends, I look around to see if any of you are there. Because I don't know what it means to all of you, and I'm not really sure how you will react. I don't want my actions to restrict or impede the work that I can do here among all of you. I don't believe that it is wrong to have a drink of alcohol, but I am cautious. I am cautious of others' beliefs and of their life stories. So I do not drink with or in front of some of my friends who have struggled with alcoholism. I don't want to be the one who is inviting them into a space that is troublesome and harmful to them. I do not want to be a part of a stumbling block for those that I care about. Hear me when I say this. I am not encouraging us to be fearful of each other or looking over our shoulder every time we do something that we think someone else might not approve of. I do wonder, does a fear of God keep us in right relationship with God and with each other? If we don't have a little or a lot of fear, does it skew how we think about ourselves and the world? One writer reflects that fearing God is good because it saves us from caving in to our own sinful nature. That's why hearing someone is God-fearing actually makes us trust that person more. If they fear God, they are more likely to keep their word and treat others with kindness. William D. Eisenhower, in an article in Christianity Today, puts it this way, and this is a long quote, but I quote, "Unfortunately, many of us presume that the world is the ultimate threat and that God functions to offset it. How different this is from the biblical position that God is far scarier than the world. When we assume that the world is the ultimate threat, we give it unwarranted power. For in truth, the world's threats are temporary. When we expect God to balance the stress of the world, we reduce God to the world's equal. As I walk with the Lord, I discover that God possesses an omniscious threat to my ego, but not to me. God rescues me from my delusions so God may reveal truth that sets me free. God casts me down only to lift me up again. God sits in judgment of my sins, but forgives me nevertheless. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but love from the Lord is its completion." End quote. Fear of God can offset or counteract our other fears. When God or an angel shows up in the Bible, they often will start with, "Fear not." Yet the person that they're showing up to talk to often already has a loving surrender before God, giving God the lead in their lives. In this way, a fear of God can indeed help us to fear not. The actions of Jesus help me to understand this. Through Jesus' death and resurrection, God has taken away one of our ultimate fears, death. Our God is bigger than death. If another cannot hold the fear of death over me, what do they have to threaten me with? When we stand before the God who created heaven and earth and bow in total devotion before that God, what do we have to fear of humans and their creation? May we push back the distractions and face God. I pray that we can stand in the overwhelming, terrifying awe of God, and in so doing, draw near to our Maker, surrendering our fears and giving God our whole life. As I close this sermon, I want us to pause for a moment and reflect. What is our fear of God? Do we draw near to God in awe and surrender? I invite you to spend a moment reflecting on your own in silence. What does the fear of God look like to you or in your life? Let's just take a moment to reflect. close this reflection time, I invite you to turn to Sing the Journey, number 27, and let's sing together about this God of the Bible.